If you don't put in the energy, there's also not going to be results. I think it's the same with any professional career. If you put in the energy, I'm confident that you will start to see results.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your organization's spend without buying an ERP, but we are not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Suzanne Ikma, Regional Director of the CFO Center, along with being a fractional CFO herself. And on today's episode, we're going to discuss stakeholder management from the very highest levels of government down to big private businesses. And we're also going to talk about a very interesting story about how Suzanne helped to exit a founder who needed to do it urgently, but just because it was urgent didn't mean that his back needed to be against a wall. And we're going to talk about navigating an exit when there's an emergency or when there's a pressing need. So Suzanne, you're very welcome to the show. Maybe you could kick us off by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Thank you, James, and thank you for the opportunity to be with you here on the Gross Profit Podcast. I'm really pleased and excited. Yeah, so I'm currently a CFO based in The Hague. Regional is south of Holland. So think of Rotterdam, The Hague, Gouda, that is my region. Something that many people don't know about me is that when I contemplated my career in my early 20s, it was either going to be finishing my master in economics or deciding to be a professional golf player. I had the opportunity to study in St. Andrews in Scotland, which is the home of golf. And the only thing I could afford in my free time there was to take some golf lessons. And I loved it so much that I continued to play a lot also when I came back to the Netherlands. And made a single handicap in about 1.5 to 2 years' time. And then really contemplated to see if I could continue on that. But nonetheless, chose to do finishing my master's in economics.
Well, the golfing's loss is our gain. So I'm glad you're on our podcast and not on Sky Sports or something. So, you know, golf, is there anything from your, that's a single handicap is, you know, it's not easy to get. Is there anything from your experience getting to that level that you take to your day-to-day? Do you think there's anything to learn from being very good at golf that you could use in your day-to-day as a CFO?
Well, definitely. I think being very focused about sports, I had to come to the conclusion is if you put in the energy, you will get in the results. If you don't put in the energy, there's also not going to be results. I think it's the same, actually, with any professional career. If you put in the energy, I'm confident that you will start to see results. If you don't, nothing's going to happen either. So 100%. Focus and putting in the energy. That is, I think, what I've learned there.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I want my kids to get into sport. We're trying to learn golf together as a family. It's a bit of a disaster, to be honest. We're going to the driving range, and I think we have a coach, and he's giving up on us, I think. But my kids are young. They're 9 and 10. But I want them to learn that, you know, variable outcomes, if you're able to live with a variable outcome, like an uncertain outcome, that's a huge unlock. And I think sport does that. Like, you learn that if you put in the effort, you don't always get the reward, but a lot of the time you do. And that's like what life is about, I think, if you're willing to take a chance on something and put in the effort without certain reward, you know, that's what
exactly.
I get from it.
And sometimes being happy with a reward that is very different than the one that you hoped for.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. What do you mean by that? You mean like you?
Well, sometimes I guess you just want to win a tournament, or you just want to have a round of golf, for example, with a certain amount of shots. And then that is not what you get out of it. But maybe you learn something else and to really seek for what is that then?
And I always imagine people who play golf have an advantage in business. Am I wrong? Has it helped you to network? Or yeah, I always think about Donald Trump on the golf course all the time. Maybe, you know, like doing business and doing deals. Maybe that's an unfair analogy, but has it helped you?
No, it hasn't really, because it is quite time consuming, as you've probably also noticed now. It's quite time consuming. So, and then when I got to spend less time on it, I enjoyed it also a little less, because I think, like I said, the energy put in is what you get out. And so I didn't get out of it as much as I had hoped. And so I haven't played until very recently, I hadn't played for about 20 years. And then I went on a golf clinic with my colleagues the other day and I tried again. The muscle memory is still there. So I'm really keen to get going again when I have a bit more time and my kids are just a bit older. They are now 12 and 10. And yeah, I'm working. So maybe golf, not now, but certainly later again. I love it.
Cool. Well, we're going to talk about stakeholder management and, you know, managing an exit in an emergency. But before we do, maybe only the best of the best get onto this podcast now, Suzanne. I don't know if you know that. So,
so maybe, honored.
Maybe you can tell us, you know, how did you rise to the ranks of being a CFO? How did you get started and where are you now? Maybe just give us a little resume.
Yeah, I did a very brief stint in PricewaterhouseCoopers as an auditor. That was right after, that was an internship followed by a short period. Auditing at that point wasn't for me. PricewaterhouseCoopers was great though, but auditing just wasn't it for me. And then I joined one of the major oil companies as a junior accountant. And I ended my career as a deputy CFO of a LNG facility, a liquid natural gas facility in the Sultanate of Brunei, which is on Borneo in Southeast Asia. And my final job was as a CFO of a chemicals manufacturing plant here in the Netherlands, just south of Rotterdam.
Very good.
So you got all your... That was about 4 years ago, and then I joined CFO Center.
Okay. And of course, places like PwC or larger companies, they pride themselves on professional development. So you got your, a lot of your training within professional organization and professional setting.
I did, yes. And I think I didn't quite appreciate how professional it was until I came to see, let's say, a less corporate environment. That doesn't mean that where I'm currently working, it isn't amazing. The companies that I currently work with is just amazing in a very different level. It's much about grit. It's much about balls. Whereas I think where I came from, it was more around a very high level of professionalism.
So I have to ask you about Brunei, because when I started this, I thought, I don't know what I thought CFOs were, but what I've come to learn is that they're much closer to diplomats than they are to, you know, technicians, you know, like very dealing with people and being able to, because you have the hard news, which has to be delivered, but how you deliver that news is what it's all about.
Yeah.
When you're working in Brunei, tell me a little bit about your role there and what you learned about how to communicate and make a board work effectively. It seems like a fairly large organization.
Yeah, it was a very large organization and my employer seconded me there. It was a joint venture, 25% owned by my employer, 25% owned by a Japanese large corporate and 50% by government. So being effective there was very different than being effective, for example, in the current companies that I work for. So there we had a board of the three shareholders. It was the CEO of the board was the crown prince of the Sultanate of Brunei. And so there was a very different way of being effective than maybe in other boards that I've been in, where, for example, board meetings were actual meetings where discussions were held and decisions were being made. Mm. Whereas, for example, in Brunei, there was a lot of work that had to be done prior to the board meetings. And we had to do a lot of stakeholder engagement and preempting all of the decisions that were going to be made. But the board meeting itself was not so much the forum to go into heavy discussions. We did that all prior.
Well, I still have advice. Even at our level, you know, we try and get all our work done before the board meeting, you know, like a lot of the work, you know, we come, we broadly know what we've decided before we do. We kind of stack the deck a little bit so the meeting can be efficient, I guess.
Yeah.
So it doesn't seem that unusual, but you make it almost sound not ceremonial, but like there was a lot more work gone into every meeting to make sure it was just everyone, no surprises. I guess that's the big deal.
Yeah, exactly. It was definitely a no surprise. That's funny that you say that, because this is definitely, for example, what the shareholder rep of my employer would say going into board meetings. There's one thing I don't like, and that is being surprised in a board meeting. But I think the same goes for government as well as for the Japanese big corporates. So that's definitely true. Whereas I think with the companies that I currently work with, things can be discussed in the board meeting still itself. And it's okay if some are a little bit more informed around a topic than maybe others, and we can all get to the same level of information, so to say, at that point in time. Whereas I think that was really not done, for example, in this venture that I worked in when I was in Brunei.
And I'm very fascinated. It seems almost, I mean, Brunei, Japan, European company, it seems like, well, how does something like that even come to be? It seems like if you were to start any company, you wouldn't necessarily put that team together. But why did it work? Like, what was the advantage of having such an international mix?
I think what worked really well there was an extreme openness and a willingness for all of us to win. At least that's what made me very successful. I think I've been really trying hard to understand how would each of these three parties win. So I've never felt that I was there. I was seconded by my employer, but it was very obvious to me that in this case, I was serving the joint venture. I wasn't serving my employer. And so I think that what made it successful was for everyone to be able to bring their strength to the table and to really appreciate that the three parties had different strengths. And then on the other hand, also being really keen that all three would win, that there would be an opportunity. And I guess that's also really the deal with joint ventures. If the joint venture wins, all the shareholders win. But sometimes it needs a bit of understanding what that really means. So the government, for example, would really appreciate employment for staff. And that might contradict to rigorous cost reductions to increase margins, for example. So it's important to understand the drivers of each of the shareholders.
Okay. So now you're working more in private industry, as I understand it, with your current clients.
Yeah.
And what's your strategy for stakeholder management then when it comes to at the board level, preparing for boards? What do you think, what have you learned about how to create an effective outcome from board meetings?
Yeah, so I think what I've learned is to really be effective with whoever is next to me. So I don't really have one strategy that I then apply to all of my clients, but I'm really looking at what is the situation here. And it can be very different. For example, with one, there are five shareholders. Two of them are less involved. Three of them are very involved at the shareholder level. And so I'm trying to understand who is really the decision maker? What do all five of them want out of this? And then how are we going to be able to get the agenda through? Which is very different from, for example, a family office, whereby there might be two brothers owning the company. And you then have to understand how is this dynamic between these two? And how can we make sure that both of them are happy with the way it is going to be done? So I really try to adjust my management style or my leadership towards my clients to be able to achieve the most. I think what is really in common is I mentioned the first time it was always about the joint venture. And if the joint venture wins, then all the shareholders win. And I really believe that is still true. So if I'm confused or if I get conflicting information, I always look at the venture and I try to understand, and that is then, I guess, very typical for a CFO. I really try to look at the data. Well, how would this venture be best off? Mm. And that is then what I try to convince the shareholders of or the board of directors of.
And how about, boards can be fairly diverse, I guess. You can have family members, not necessarily, they would have different skills. They could be from marketing, they could be from NGO, it could be whatever. And then how do you approach, I always think of Richard Branson, who has a story about how he was at a board meeting and they were discussing the accounts. And after the meeting, he was already quite advanced in his career. And the CFO pulled him aside. Through the course of the discussion at the board meeting, the CFO realized Richard doesn't actually know the difference between gross and net. And after the meeting, he had a meeting where I said, listen, I just want to point, are you totally clear on what gross and net is? And he said, what are you talking about? And he didn't mean. But anyway, that was a great example of how a CFO kind of was able to identify a weakness. Obviously, we all want to be Richard Branson, so he's doing pretty well for himself. But then was able to explain it, So have you come across that where you're able to see, I guess making sure everyone's equally informed is something you have to focus on, because you can't assume that everyone knows even what the different things on the balance sheet mean or even what the sales jargon is. And everyone has their own jargon, so I guess they all love to use it.
Yeah, I agree. So how do I then approach it to get everybody similarly or informed?
I'm just wondering, have you seen that? Is that a thing?
Yeah.
Or are you worried, Do you have to keep an eye on it, to make sure it's working well? Do you have to watch out for that?
Well, definitely. And I totally agree with you that people have different levels of information and also very different levels of energy for the balance sheet and the P&L and the cash flow statement. So I always also try to make it for those who are in a decision authority, that if this is not where their level of energy is, that's great. I mean, I'm happy to take it away from them and take care of it, but I do need them to, at some level, understand it and to be able to make a decision. So I'm really keen, indeed, to make it as easy as possible or as fun as possible for somebody with no energy for finance to then still get them to the level of information that I think they should have to be able to make an informed decision about their company. Others are indeed very much on the ball. But I have to say, what I really enjoy also working with the clients that we currently have is I'm actually very amazed how long an entrepreneur is able to do the right things based on bank accounts, for example. So I came in from this corporate with this very strong view around level of assurance around controls, for example, or around reporting on a monthly basis or in a fast-moving organization, even on a weekly basis. I had this very strong view about how it was supposed to go. And what I really enjoy now is that I also come to the conclusion there are really a lot of different ways to roam, and clearly my clients are doing awesome. So I have really also adjusted my view on, let's say, the world in that sense, on what it can and what it should look like. And so I'm even more focused on a risk-based approach. I do really feel it's important to understand where risks are. And those I think you should be informed about. But in that, I've come to understand to an understanding that the risks aren't always that high and things can go really well, like I said, for a very long time by just checking the bank accounts very regularly. So that's, I find that really interesting.
Yeah, you mentioned the balance sheet there. On our board meeting, we have one, finance focused person, and we joke, we all focus on the income statement because we can understand that. And then we like to give Ronan his moment in the sun to talk about the balance sheet. We don't really know what he's talking about, but we know it's important, so he keeps us off the rocks.
Nice.
So listen, you had a very nice story. You were telling me about a 79-year-old entrepreneur, I guess, one of these guys who had just really been self-made, but there was an emergency and they needed to exit their business. I guess this is the fear that a lot of us have, is that you do this work maybe for decades, on your business with the intention that one day you should be able to, set up your retirement or whatever, but it doesn't always go according to plan. So this gentleman needed to exit fast and then he came to you. Maybe you could tell us a bit about the story.
Yeah, of course. So this is one of my first clients that I took on at CFO Center. And this was a 79-year-old entrepreneur, major shareholder in his company. And he needed to exit for health reasons. And there was no succession also in place. So there was, for example, not in his family, neither were there employees who were willing to take over. And because of the health issues, there was quite an urgency to get it done. And I think what I felt when I joined him was that he felt that he was with his back against the wall. And when we started to look at the company, it wasn't in great financial health. It had been running at about zero for a couple of years. And the line in the last decades clearly was in a declining mode. And I think that he felt he was I think that he didn't feel he was in a position of power. And we then started to work on understanding, well, where is the biggest value leak? And can we then already take out? And if we do that, can we then see what happens to the bottom line, for example? Or can we then see what happens with the results? And I was convinced it was a good company because by taking just a very few decisions on value leaks, we immediately saw a very strong decline. So we knew that something in the operations, something about how we were running the business was amazing. Otherwise, it wouldn't be so fast in picking up the line to profitability again. Mm-hmm. And then we said, okay, well, how long should we do this before we can then actually start to go out on the market? And we actually decided not to wait. So we felt that we were able to identify which strings can a potential investor pull that will pull up the line even further. And if we identify those and we can outline, we will leave it for you to then either do this or you come up with all of the other opportunities that you see, for example, as the investor, I don't know, synergies or whatever other opportunity scale this investor saw. But we would identify all of those. And we went to market then also quite quickly. And that appeared to be enough. And we were really in a very strong position of power at that point because the health issues weren't, I mean, he was still very able to, you know, to front the discussions also. His son was very helpful in the process. We were there. There was also a specialist in terms of looking for potential investors. So there was an M&A specialist. And so together, it was actually quite quickly we had a storyline together that we had a gem in hand. Okay, it wasn't really run very smoothly for the last decade, but just doing a few things would immediately pull up the line and we would be back to profitability. And it was very obvious that we could show positive cash flow, let's say for the next coming years. And so we sold within, I think, 9 months or so at a really great multiple on the EBITDA. So we were ultimately really, the entrepreneur was really beyond pleased and it was way more than he had expected.
Very interesting. It does strike me that, you know, the difference between reality and potential, sometimes people value potential more once it's crystallized. If you had crystallized those savings and you could see it working, I guess, you know, it becomes very black and white and mathematical, if you like. But if there's potential, which hasn't been achieved yet, sometimes it's people risky. Maybe value that more because they believe, oh, well, I can actually do better than that. And I can, they like to be optimistic, I guess. So
I think so. And I think that's good, right? If you have the feeling, hey, but I am the right person to really drive this now home, why not? But it is risky. So, and that was definitely, of course, also discounted. Potential is riskier than this very clear storyline of the past that has been, that is showcasing, for example, great results.
And one last question on this, which is, you know, when people are buying businesses, it's oftentimes not the first business they bought. When you're selling one, it's more likely it's maybe the only one you've ever sold. Is it tough? Is it a tough process? Like, is it emotionally difficult? Were there times where someone wanted to give up, or I guess you had no choice in this situation? But how difficult is it, you know, to manage the emotions when you're going through these very big decisions, probably one of the biggest decisions of your career?
In this case, so the 79-year-old, it was emotional for him, but not because it was the first time. He had sold businesses before. But for the other four shareholders who were minor shareholders, it was the first time and probably also the only time. And it was emotional. But I agree. So one of the CFOs in my team is currently also guiding an exit of another entrepreneur in the maritime sector. And he's run an incredible company for the past 20 years. And this is definitely going to be it, so to say. And so it has to be great. And yeah, it is emotional. It's also, I think it was emotional to make the decision after several discussions with our CFOs that it was going to be an exit, that it was that decision and it was not going to be, for example, internationalization, because he was still on that path and he ultimately chose exit. So I think also that decision was emotional, but now the process is very emotional because we're very aware he's going to do this once. He's going to look back on this one decision for a very long time and we want it to be really excellent.
Well, another guest who's certified in exit planning told me that 80% of people who do, 80% of businesses that go to market don't sell, first of all, which I was surprised by. And then a lot of people who have a business sort of think, well, this is my pension, this is whatever, but you know, there's a very real risk. You never sell a business. And then 70% of people who, having sold 18 months later, regretted the decision. Like it's, which is kind of shocking to me, but not surprising in some ways, like your whole identity and everything can be built around, you know, building something. So you've mentioned CFO Center. I'd like to hear a little bit about more this. Now, obviously, CFO Center is quite established. And maybe you can tell me a bit about your team that you work with here. And is it a partnership? What sort of organization is it? And how did you become involved?
Yeah, sure. So if I can just take you back 22 years, James, this is when it was founded by a Brit named Colin Mills. He's the founder of CFO Center. He was at that time the CFO for Mars. And he was waking up in another hotel room, not knowing where he was. And the day was going to look the same as maybe some of the others. And he decided that he wanted to make a different design of life, so to say, or a different lifestyle. And that is when he stopped and then started to work as a fractional CFO for the companies within his remit, so to say, of his home. And 22 years later, that is exactly what we're still doing. We focus on small to medium-sized enterprises. I always say, think of targeting between 2 and 50 million euros turnover, about 10 to 50 FTEs. Mm-hmm. And we are active with about 900 CFOs now in 19 countries who work on a freelance basis. And then we obviously have a deduction that then goes into CFO Center. And we've been doing this for 22 years. We do fractional C-suite, but only the CFO role. And in the Netherlands and Belgium, we are one organization, one country organization. We are about 35 CFOs. And my team in South Holland is currently a team of 7. And we all aim for a full portfolio, and that can be different for everybody. It can be full, can mean 3 days, full can be 5 days. So it's a very flexible setup in that sense.
So for CFO Center, I mean, I guess a lot of people might be working in what I call the belly of the beast in a big organization. You're working somewhere on a finance team. And does the number one, there's only two challenges I see fractional CFOs having. One is finding customers, and the other one is getting rid of customers, like, you know, the ones they don't want. What does CFO Center offer to someone who hasn't stepped out yet? Like, why not just do it by yourself? Or what are the advantages to sort of becoming part of a group like that?
So for me, the advantage is really still being part of an international network. So the idea of doing something really on my own wasn't appealing enough to me. What we do is that regional directors take care of the acquisition and are also taking care of account management. So if you're a CFO and you struggle with the concept of selling yourself, then this could be a really great option. But definitely, if you want to be part of something that is a bit bigger than just yourself, then this is a great way of still having peers. We meet each other in the country organization twice per year for a conference, which is around team building, but it's also about keeping up with the latest, for example, on AI or ESG reporting, whatever we want to discuss at that point in time. And what I have really learned was that it is easier to transition from a corporate job, which is very different from a freelance portfolio job. And it has really helped me to get tips and tricks on how you make that transition. And like I said, I've been with, for example, PricewaterhouseCoopers for a very small part of my career. But what I have noticed that, for example, people, partners from accountancy firms are way better in dealing with multiple clients than I was at the beginning, because I simply wasn't used to having a suite of clients who I needed to service. So having one notebook per client, for example, was such an interesting tip from one of my peers who said, at least get yourself organized and really be mentally starting up in the morning for that client and then also mentally winding down from that client at the end of the day so that you're ready for the next one and the day after. So these were very simple things to discuss, but that made the transition for me a lot easier. It's just very different than getting a full-time CFO job, let's say, on your plate every week, and you just need to make sure that you're somewhat finished Friday night. From this, it's very different.
Very good. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about, like, who do you really thrive in working with? What's your ideal, as I call it, chef's kiss, perfect customer? Who do you love to work with?
I think what all of us really love to work with is clients with a very strong ambition and therefore go through a triggering event. And then I mean, for example, needing to fundraise or first of all, maybe deciding on a growth strategy. If that growth strategy needs funding, that we go out and find and raise money. Those are typical things that we do. If that is a buy and build strategy, to go on the hunt for targets, do the acquisitions, and then integrate those acquisitions into the company. But also exit preparation and exits, like we talked about just now, those are really typical things that we do, and that is what keeps us busy. I don't know how about you, James. I also feel that SMEs who don't have these kind of triggering events, that they can do perfectly well with an awesome controller and their accountant. And I think also that the CFOs that we typically hire at CFO Center are the ones that actually love to go through those triggering events. Those are the kind of things that we feel that we can really play our parts in.
Very good. Okay. And you have a wonderful term phrase, which I haven't heard before, which is, you know, you help people who get no energy from, you know, some parts of their business, which I think is a wonderful way of saying it, you know. So from a client perspective out there, people, how can you make their life better, I guess? Even doing a process, an exit process, there's a lot of paperwork that comes with it, right? There's a lot of awkward questions, a lot of, you know, people wanting things in formats you're not used to, etc.
Yeah.
And how can you facilitate that so they can, because one of the things with an exit or an M&A or anything is that if you don't concentrate on the business can go off the rails, right, very quickly.
Yeah.
And if you're trying to do two things, it can end badly. You're trying to run the business and you're trying to raise money, or you're trying to run the business, you're trying to exit. You know, they don't always work very well together.
Yeah, I agree, because they're very intensive processes, aren't they? Mm-hmm. And especially when you're scaling up, running the business itself is more than a full-time job, let alone on the side, you're trying to raise money or you're trying to integrate an acquisition. But like you mentioned, we also have clients who are at a position where they come to the conclusion, I don't enjoy, or I get no energy from the conversations with my banks, with my accountants, with my investors. And I always tell them, yeah, there are really crazy people like us, and we actually love to take that over from you. So we also have that. But yeah, most definitely on the really exciting times in an entrepreneurial journey, we can definitely take care of some of the things that are very time consuming. They're one-off. You're going through a steep learning curve, but you're very unlikely to be able to use all of that learning anytime soon again. And we have gone through it many times. We will go through it many times. And so we are happy to take care of it, whether that is through getting financing in place or indeed, for example, an exit.
Very good. So what's the best way people can reach out or get in touch with you, Suzanne?
Well, definitely connecting on LinkedIn. I really enjoy that. You can also send me an email. It is Suzanne.Eikema. I think my name is down at the bottom. I get the spelling right because it's quite awkward. Suzanne.Eikema@cfocenter.com. But you can also just visit any of our websites in any of the countries that you are in and find the contact page and contact us there.
Thank you very much. And listener, thank you very much for listening. If you got this deep into the podcast, I'd like to give you a special reward for staying with Suzanne and me. And my reward to you today is to be able to go to procurementexpress.com/newsletter. Well, why would you want to be on our newsletter? Does anyone really like newsletters? Well, we have a different newsletter for you. What I've discovered, Suzanne, is that actually, when I just, you know, you can sign up for our newsletter to get notified about our podcasts and get great advice from people like yourself, which is great. But the secret sauce to getting people to read my newsletter is to actually survey the news from the last week and find the financial mishaps that people have tripped themselves up with over the last week and then report on them. So it's a little bit vicarious. It's a little bit tabloid. I won't lie. You know, we had Naomi Campbell in the newsletter a few weeks ago because her charity wasn't handling their funds the way they should have been handling them. But there's little lessons from local government, from small business, different ways that people have tripped up, sometimes with serious implications. And it's something that we can all learn from so we can avoid. So for that reason, I'm going to invite you all to come and join the newsletter to stay on top of what's going on out there. And that's it. Thank you. Thank you very much for being on the show. I really enjoyed it.
Me too, James. Thank you so much.